We're outside again, Wolfram.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
Yes.
Hello, everyone. Hi, Charles. And we are outside and enjoying the great weather and food in Hawaii. But what's even more amazing is actually the people that are around.
Absolutely.
And so this time I'm with John Rushby, who heads the Dependable Systems Group in SRI in Stanford.
Excellent.
And it's a real pleasure to be with John because he is really a long time in our business, and he was recently just awarded the Harlan D. Mills Prize.
Nice.
For his contributions to security and formal methods, and I don't know exactly the saying of the award, but in some sense for his lifetime achievements. And I thought we could talk a little bit about his career, SRI, and what he's currently passionate about.
Awesome.
John.
Okay, well, thank you, Wolfram. Charles.
Hi.
So, let me begin in the beginning. I have one of the oldest computer science degrees in the world. I graduated almost exactly 40 years ago.
Wow.
And the reason is that I was a sort of a wizard with slide rules and other labor-saving devices as a math student, but you couldn't do addition that way. And
yeah.
So I thought, wow, you know, this is getting really tedious. And so I started to learn how to use one of the calculating machines we had. And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be better if you could automate this? And we were invited to go to the local technical college and learn Fortran, Fortran 2, I think it was in those days. And so spent about, one afternoon a week for about 3 months learning Fortran. And then we got to write our first Fortran program, punch it out on punch cards, and put it in the mail. And it was sent to the computer. It was an IBM 7090 at one of the colleges at London University. And we waited, you know, for the next lesson, the next week, for our output. And I was waiting confidently for my list of prime numbers to arrive, and instead I got syntax error. And so this has inculcated in me a concern for trying to get things right the first time,
yeah.
And not to spend too many iterations in debugging. So it was sufficiently interesting computing that I chose to do it as my my degree subject. So I studied computer science at University of Newcastle upon Tyne, north of England. I'm originally from the south. And as I say, got a computer science degree in 1971, and that was about probably the second year you could get a computer science degree in England. I'm not sure about the United States. We learned things like compiler construction, operating systems, data structures, programming languages. The language we used mostly then, I think towards the end, was Algol W, beautiful language designed by Niklas Wirth and implemented by Ed Setterthwaite, who was one of our professors there.
Nice.
A lot of visiting Americans in those days. And so that's my early career.
So how did you come from England then to SRI?
So after I had got my PhD and spent some very enjoyable years teaching at Manchester University, I was invited to join a new research project at Newcastle on computer security. And one of the things that attracted me about this project was they had plenty of funding for visiting the United States. It was felt that the United States had most of the technology that was important. They invented the idea of security kernels and what's called the reference monitor idea. There's a significant report called the Anderson Panel Report that had been published a few years before. And of course they had verification technology. Well, we thought they did. And it was believed even then that if you're trying to guarantee critical properties like security or safety, you should provide very strong evidence. And so joined that project and did indeed spend quite a number of very interesting trips to the United States, visiting the various sites. There were maybe four main sites in those days that were doing research in program verification. The Don Goods Group down in Texas, who had a system called Gypsy. There was Boyer Moore, who in those days were at SRI. They later moved to Texas. And then there was the other group at SRI that worked with Shostak, Malia Smith, and others, who developed some very interesting decision procedures. Hmm. There was a group at Stanford under David Luckham, and there was a group down at USC, University of Southern California, ISI, who had a very interesting language called Affirm, system called Affirm. And there was also some activity on the East Coast, but mostly it was West Coast. And what attracted me even then was the idea that, first of all, formal methods were all about being able to calculate the behavior of your software. I was never interested in it as an intellectual discipline, the idea that treated programming as a mathematical exercise. I was interested in treating it as an engineering exercise where you build models and you calculate their behavior. And I realized then that you needed decision procedures to do this. And for the next 20 years, decision procedures were exclusively a West Coast activity.
Okay.
So that was one of the reasons why I went there. Let me tell you a little bit about SRI, since we mentioned this earlier. I'd like to, I'm going to enjoy this, tell you Microsoft people about who invented the mouse.
All right. Tell us who invented the mouse.
So, actually, let's go right back to the beginning. SRI used to be the Stanford Research Institute. It was founded just after the Second World War, around about 1946, by some Bay Area businessmen who felt that they needed access to some sort of local research capability. In those days, what is now Silicon Valley was all peach orchards and agriculture. And SRI was, say, founded as a part of Stanford, and we got some very attractive land. There was a big hospital that had been built to receive the wounded who would come back from the invasion of Japan. It was an eye hospital, actually. And of course, the invasion of Japan never occurred. The hospital was never needed or used and became SRI's facilities. And if you ever visit us, you can still see much of the original hospital walls, the shacks, as they're called. Anyway, the first big project was funded by the Bank of America, who wanted to see if they could automate some of their processes. And in those days, a check was just a handwritten artifact. You know, you wrote the name of the recipient, the amount, and your name. And when it got to the bank, they would say, oh, this is John Rushby's check. They'd read my name. And so SRI developed systems for marking checks. They invented the whole idea of checking account numbers and other radical innovations, the strange writing on the bottom of a check. That comes from that project. But they also built the first computer on the West Coast. It was a sort of hardwired machine called IRMA, electronic something, something, something. I think the A was accounting. And it worked. And Bank of America was very happy. And as I say, it led to modern automation of clerical type processes. There was some competition for who should build the production version of the IRMA computer. And that was won by General Electric. And that's how GE got into the computer business. We were building the IRMA Mark II. So SRI developed. There were probably 3,000 people there in the 60s. And lots of interesting projects. And in particular, there was a young guy called Doug Engelbart, who had been working at, I think, at NASA Ames prior to that. He was working at SRI and leading a project on human augmentation. The idea that computers could be much more than just clerical devices or scientific calculators. He really had the idea that they could assist the human brain. And he had a very generous line of funding for quite a while from DARPA, which had only just been created in the aftermath of the Sputnik. It was called ARPA in those days, actually. And developed, in many ways, the whole modern world. So there's a very famous demo that was performed in 1968. One of the things that's amazing about it is it was held in San Francisco, whereas the computers were all in Menlo Park, which is 40 miles away, and they had satellite links connecting this stuff together. And if you can see the demo, I think it's on a Stanford site called Mouse Site. It's really worth watching because he really had the whole modern world. He had invented the mouse. He also had a cording keyboard under his other hand. Multi-window displays, hypertext, graphical user interface, input. It's just amazing to watch. He had the whole thing. Well, as is the way of the world, funding dried up at some point, and the group broke up and went away. And most of the group, but not Engelbart himself, went to Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, and that's how that group really got that kickstart in that direction. They obviously had some very talented people of their own, but that's the general drift of that part of the story. Another big project, of course, at that time was the ARPANET. DARPA itself had really far-thinking people who had this idea that you could link computers together, and so the first map of the ARPANET had four nodes on it, and the only one that was multiply connected was SRI. We were connected to both Utah and Santa Barbara, I believe. Mm. And the very first internet connection, sorry, first ARPANET connection, the very first wide area network communication was a login, I think, from Santa Barbara to SRI.
Amazing.
The internet also started at SRI. The protocols, of course, were designed by WinSurf and others, but the first actual interconnection of two different networks was at SRI, where the ARPANET was connected to our packet radio system. Mm. We had mobile vans, probably 3-ton vans, that drove around the Bay Area, exchanging data at maybe 128 bits per second. And these are the modern equivalent of a cell phone, you know, a 3-ton van. And the first internet connection was between the packet radio net and the regular ARPANET. So I'm very happy and pleased and proud to belong to an organization with such a long and interesting history.
So if you actually look into the current investment that SRI is doing, so at that time you really pushed the science forward. If you now have great science, sometimes you build startups and they get be sold to other famous company. Can you talk about how that works? If you have great invention today, how that's actually multiplied and given to the world?
Okay, so indeed, our president and the other members of the leadership are very keen that there should be startup activity. And it's the usual sort of thing. If you have a good idea, then they can either fund or help you find some sort of startup arrangements. You can run an incubator in-house. We actually have quite a lot of spare space at the moment because we're not as big as we used to be. And you can also, just start up outside with some SRI holding a bit of the equity. There have been quite a few successful companies like that. The best known that I can recall at the moment is Nuance. So that's a speech understanding company. If you call a lot of companies like United Airlines, you're going to have a dialogue with a natural language understanding system. And that's SRI's Nuance. It was at one time valued at over $1 billion. It was bought out by somebody who bought out. I forget who owns it now, but that was another one. Let's see, another one? Well, there's an opportunity that Microsoft missed. We recently sold an outfit called Siri to Apple for an undisclosed amount, but it was a lot. And it's a very smart combination of AI technologies that sits on an iPhone. And speech understanding, natural language understanding, geolocation, database lookup, that kind of thing. So, it's been successful, and not so far in the area of formal methods. We still have to go to work and draw a salary, I'm afraid.
Yeah, let's go back to such as your area of expertise. So, you mentioned earlier you worked, when you came to SRI, there was a lot of ideas of decision procedures. So decision procedures are, there's in some sense a little theory, like something about numbers, and then you can ask queries whether a certain equality, inequality holds, and so on. So, but today we see in some sense that decision procedures and modern theorem provers have really taken off. That's the satisfiability modulo theory provers. But I think lots of the foundation was actually also laid at SRI by Shostak and others. Can you talk a little bit about, in some sense, your line of work and how this all fits in?
Okay. So when I joined SRI, there were already some existing systems there. There was Boyer-Moore's theorem prover, which was based on Lisp, but it did have arithmetic decision procedures in it. And there was Shostak's work. Shostak basically had some integrated decision procedures, but not much else. And around about that time, they had built a sort of a wrapper around that so that you could, with some difficulty, express larger fragments of your problem and coerce it through the decision procedure. But there was no way of directly interacting with it. What you had to do was to sort of anticipate ahead of time the direction you wanted it to follow and give it the necessary hints. And perhaps I should back up a little bit here and amplify what Wolfram said. Basic idea in theorem proving is basically search. Your program works for some reason or other, and one way of trying that out is testing, and you can explore lots and lots of finite tests, but that doesn't cover everything. So the idea of formal methods is you express things symbolically. So instead of putting the numbers 2 and 3 through, you put the letters, you know, the variables X and Y through, do symbolic evaluation, and then try to see if you can reduce that symbolic expression to what you want, you know, like the answer is meant to be X plus Y. Yeah, so you're going to expand out all the different operations in your program, have this huge logical expression, then you need to apply these rules to see if you can squeeze it down so that it does end up saying, yes, that's X plus Y. And these rules that you apply are the axioms of arithmetic and so on. And the question is, you've got to find out which rules to apply and which order to apply them in, and how to instantiate the meta variables that you've got for all X and for all Y. You've got to instantiate that, or exists X, exists Y, you've got to instantiate those meta variables. And so it's a huge search. And how does one organize that search? Well, you can have humans guide you, and that's interactive theorem proving. Or you can try to just mechanize it by brute force. And one way is to try and sort of break up the total problem. And so you say, okay, we're not going to try and mechanize the exists and the for alls. We are going to try and mechanize the rules of arithmetic, say. And that will give you decision procedures for arithmetic. And so we had those, and but we didn't have automation for the exists and the for alls. And so the way you steered the proof was by supplying those ahead of time. But of course, you had to guess right now what they're going to be, you know, halfway through the proof. And so it was a very painful process. You know, often what you would do is you'd print out the intermediate state of the proof when it worked, and you know, before and afterwards, and hold it up to the light, you know, with two different sheets of paper, so you could see the difference in the parentheses. So not very attractive or effective, but you know, better than some of the alternatives. Better than not automating arithmetic. So, around about 1983, the National Computer Security Center decided it was going to really get going and invest in support for the existing verification systems so that they could support the development of secure systems. And most of the organizations involved basically just ported their existing systems over to the Multics systems that the Computer Security Center was using. That's all right, to a gamble, and thought they could build a new system for that, the amount of money that was available. So we built a thing called Enhanced HDM, and that was really quite a capable system, very, very nice language. It's the antecedent of the system we have now, called PBS, very, very similar language. Had predicate subtyping, just a beautiful way of organizing the types. But it still had this sort of predict in advance the instantiations. But we managed to do some quite hard proofs. There's one that von Henke and I did, verifying Byzantine fault-tolerant clock synchronization, which is a pretty challenging problem for the time. And the journal proof, which appears in the Journal of the ACM, was developed by Leslie Lamport and Michael Melia-Smith, and it has five lemmas and a main theorem. And we found that all but one of the lemmas and the main theorem are somewhat false, exactly as written. And you can correct them fairly simply, but that was an interesting experience, that you really could find issues in, you know, succinct pieces of mathematical program development done by people who really knew what they were doing. So the next development was that Shankar joined our group from working with McCarthy. He did his PhD under Boyram Moore, and his thesis was a mechanical verification of Gödel's incompleteness theorems. So really amazing achievements. Published as a book, if you like a copy. Now in its second edition, second issue. But he had a lot of insights from the other systems that he had worked on, and he was the primary creator PVS, along with Sam Orr, who did a lot of the implementation work. And PVS was interactive. It allowed you to get inside and guide the proof as it was developing. So that was a step forward, but you still need this human interaction. And what we found when we were trying to take this to engineers is, you know, they didn't know anyone in their organization who had the talent or the interest to do that. People like us, it's a video game. You know, we enjoy it, we have fun, but that's not what most engineers wanted to do. And so it was clear that the automation level had to be increased. And also you had to find better ways of explaining what you were doing as well. That's another thing we learned. Anyway, as Wolfram says, one of the big step forwards was the, first of all, outside of our group, the development of really fast SAT solvers. So that's a sort of fundamental part of search. It's the quintessential MP complete problem. But that doesn't mean to say that in practice you can't do it really fast. And there was a breakthrough around about 1990, with a system called CHAF, where the first time set solving was really pretty fast. And that excited a lot of people. And in particular, folks working on the decision procedures at SRI, Leonardo Damara, Howard Roos, Maria Soria, started to think maybe we could put the decision procedures, which only decide conjunctions of terms, together with a set solver, and then we could decide arbitrarily propositionally complex formulas. And so we built the first modern SMT solver, as it's now come to be called. It's called ICS. And that was really pretty effective. And out of that, first of all, we organized a sort of an evaluation of other approaches and showed that the approach we were following did look like the most promising. It's the approach known as the lazy approach. And that did two things. It, first of all, got people really excited about SMT solving, and secondly, it institutionalized the idea of competition. And that really led to the very rapid development of that technology. I'm not so sure it's effective now. It's becoming, people can game the system now, but certainly for the first few years, it really had value in showing what worked and what didn't. And so a very, very rapid advance in the capabilities of SMT solvers, and very happy that technology transferred to Microsoft. Not so happy that it transferred in the form of the person of Leonardo Damara, but I know he's very happy there. So it's a very attractive and breakthrough technology, and really sort of makes possible the automation of really interesting problems of this kind that I described, where you evaluate programs or specifications symbolically, and then you can say, how does it behave under all possible circumstances? That's the big win, all possible circumstances.
Wow. So, in fact, we've built a similar prover with the help of a former SRI person, Leonardo Damara, and it has changed the whole program analysis space, because you can translate almost every problem that you want, every question that you have about the program, you can translate that into a formula, and you translate the program into a formula, and then you can use theorem prover to answer it. So we're using it for automatic test case generation, using it for verification, we are using it for design space exploration, we are using it and actually shipping it with Windows 7 as part of the static driver verifier. Nice. There's actually a theorem prover built in there, and in some sense the roots go back to the work that has been done at SRI, so in some sense that's great to see. You are actually the head of the dependable system, so it's clear that in some sense program verification is still not as cost effective as testing, but there are certain areas where it might actually be already more cost effective, and that's really dependable systems. Can you say what are the systems that in some sense where you see that verification could have already an impact? And
Well, so you hinted at one point there, which is that the low-hanging fruit for verification for this technology is bug finding. You can find bugs much better using these formal methods techniques than you can by most of the ordinary kind of testing techniques, simply because you can explore all the paths and find the one that's going to generate the bug or manifest the bug. And so in a lot of areas, it's bug finding that is the main selling point for formal methods. But I've always felt that the real problem is verification, guaranteeing that there are no bugs. Now, in some areas, that's sort of enough. But the question is, safety critical systems, what does that really mean? So safety critical systems, the point is you have to think of everything that can go wrong, okay? And then you have to show that you've developed a treatment for all those things, and you've done it correctly. So sort of correctness is part of the problem. But there's this other problem of anticipating everything. You have to think of everything. And so in many areas, I think safety critical systems, that is where the new frontier is. And not so much in verifying correctness of implementations, but in trying to discover what are called the hazards, trying to discover the flaws or potential flaws that lie in your conception of the system. Now, before we go there, perhaps let's touch on the verification. People like Tony Hoare, now with Microsoft, believes that there should be a grand challenge in verifying software. My personal belief is that it's a technology that's coming along. There's been, there's continual progress. It's basically the problem of invariant generation. You know, I want to guarantee that my system achieves some property. I write that property down as a postcondition, I annotate my program with various preconditions that I can think of, and then I hit it with the SMT solver. And the SMT solver cannot prove it because it needs to know some other stuff. And you have to say, oh, well, in this loop here, you know, this equals that or something. And it's the discovery of those invariants. You can't expect programmers to provide that level of annotation. And so it's the discovery of those ancillary invariants that I think is the challenge for the future. But it is a challenge that's being addressed month by month, year by year. The technology gets better, and I think it'll get there in 10 or 15 years' time. A lot of interesting commentary here from the children.
This is all
the calls.
Hey,
yeah.
You said everything.
All right. So, you know, I think the correctness problem for, you know, code level stuff, you know, will be taken care of in time by the march of technology. That's my optimistic belief. But in safety critical systems, there's this issue of understanding, thinking of everything. And so, what interests me at the moment is the questions of how can I anticipate all of the things that my software might encounter. And there are some ideas for how one might do this. So one would be, let's build a very abstract model of our system. It has to be abstract because we haven't built it yet. You know, so it's going to be the moral equivalent of a sketch. Okay, at the moment, what people do is they write pictures down, and then they have a kind of SAT solver called a bog SAT, a bunch of guys sitting around a table. And they try to anticipate and think of all the things that can go wrong. So instead, we want to find some way of writing down as a very abstract program, very abstract description, this level of sketch for our system, and then a sketch of the environment with no constraints upon it. And then we let the theorem prover examine all possible interactions, and it will say, hey, you've got a problem here. And then you examine, if you're doing it manually, examine the counterexample and say, ah, that can't happen because I have this constraint on the environment. And if you assert that, you better be sure the environment, you know, really is going to guarantee that constraint. Or you can say, ah, I really need to think about that and take care of it, and I adjust my design to take care of that. And you can iterate this process. Now, this idea of sort of manually inspecting the counterexamples can be partially automated using learning methods. And so there are, I think, some hope for how one goes about trying to anticipate these higher level issues of requirements, synthesis, and hazard discovery.
So in substance, what this is really about is really understanding the environment and its impact on the program. Right?
Right.
We can control the program, we can verify it, but how does it actually fit in? Which sensors can go can break during the development, and what does it impact for the correctness of the program? And examples for security relevant software is air traffic controllers, flight controllers, maybe cars, pacemakers.
Right.
So another interesting tendency or discussion is going on is that many of those software artifacts have to be certified so that they by the FDAA or something, that, so that it can be used in airplanes. So how does your work impact that area as well? Do we have to, in some sense, probably prove our software correct in the future if we want to use it in pacemakers, or how does it evolve?
So there are two basic approaches to certification. There's the approach which is most common at present, which is based on standards. So a group of people working for some professional society or for some government agency with, you know, years of experience get down and describe a prescribed approach or the sort of things you should do and think about, and you find these standards like for airplane software, DO-178B, just about to become DO-178C. And that can work in very stable fields. If you think about it, what's really going on is you have some goals or claims that you want to make about safety. The aeroplane will never crash. The infusion pump will never fail to deliver or, you know, over-deliver the drug or whatever. So you have a goal or a claim. You also have some analysis that you have done. You've tested it, or you've formally analyzed it, or you've done requirements tracing and all these other good things. And you have some we call that the evidence, okay? And you then have an argument that connects the evidence to the claim. You say that because I've done all these things, like testing and verification, I have an argument that shows you why this cannot happen, this cannot happen, this cannot happen, and therefore the claim is justified. So claims, evidence, argument is the overall structure of any assurance, really. Now, in the case of a standard, what's really going on is that the standard describes the evidence you have to deliver, and the argument was hashed out in that meeting that produced the standard. If you weren't in that standard committee, you might not know what the argument is, and hence you don't really know why some of the evidence is required or what it's actually delivering. So in the case of the most critical aeroplane software, there's a testing requirement called MCDC, Modified Condition Decision Coverage, which is a moderately onerous structural coverage criteria. And the idea is you have to achieve this level of coverage on the code while generating your tests from the requirements. Now, if you ask people why that's in the standard, they'll say it's to ensure that you've done good testing. And that's one of the reasons. But it's also there for two other reasons. And if you were not in the meeting, you might not know what these are. One is to force you to write really good low-level requirements. Because if you're going to generate the requirements off the code, sorry, off the requirements, but get high coverage on the code, the requirements have got to be very close to the code. And so it forces the development of very detailed low-level requirements. The other is it guarantees the absence of unintended function. That's the thing they really worry about in aeroplanes, is there's something in there that can happen that you didn't know about. There's dead code that isn't dead. And if you can't get coverage from the requirements on all the code, then that code may be dead, or you know, potentially potentially come alive. So the problem with assurances, the standards is that you don't necessarily know why all the stuff is there. And so if you have a slightly variant problem, you might not know how to adjust things. But also, it's most effective when things develop slowly, where you can build the wisdom of the previous generation into the new generation. So in the case of baby carriages, there's only so many ways, you know, that unfortunate things can happen to babies. And there's a standard that lists, you know, like 67 really horrible things that can happen in a baby carriage. And you just have to show that your baby carriage, you know, doesn't do any of those, and you can be reasonably confident that it's safe. And with aeroplanes, there's not a lot of change from one generation to the next, and they tend to sort of revamp the standard with each generation. But it's like 10 or 20 years between generations. But medical devices, massive innovation going on. All sorts of different devices serving all sorts of different purposes. They're often developed by, you know, a bunch of pair of doctors in a garage, you know, not by some massive institutional organization with a safety culture like Boeing. There it's felt that maybe standards aren't the way to go. And what you should do is go back to this idea that you have claims, evidence, and argument, and ask the developer to actually produce the argument. And that is a safety case, in essence. And so a challenge for people like us is, what's the relationship between a safety case and a verification? And I don't know the answer to that, but a safety case has got a lot of it is verification, you know, and guarantee that the software has these properties. But then there's a lot of more tricky things that sort of intangibles. And part of my aim for the future is to see if one can sort of shrink the intangibles and increase the amount of verification so that the safety case starts to become a more scientifically grounded means of producing evidence and less of the reams of paper. So for certification, that's the sort of the high end, you know, the medical devices and the aeroplanes and the cars. What could happen at the lower end? Well, I was recently on a National Academy study, produced a report called, the study was called Sufficient Evidence, and actually I forget the name of the actual report, but what we recommended, in essence, was essentially the idea of a safety case, but adjusted to the needs of the organization. So that, for example, if you're selling software and hardware to families, you might want to say, the file system on this system has been certified to have the following properties. And then perhaps Consumer Reports, or someone else would say, that if you want to store your photos, then you really ought to think about buying a device that has this label on the tin, as the English say, this sticker on the box. And so that you get some sort of consumer demand for certain levels of assurance. And that assurance, as I say, would be backed by claims, evidence, and argument that would be hopefully be open. And so independent bodies could examine that and say, yeah, this holds together. And so that's one approach it might go. I rather hope it does go in that direction. The idea that we declaim all responsibility for our products is really...
We are the only field that currently can do that.
Right.
And I think it's time to be a little bit more reflective on our deliverables and our abilities. And I think with the technologies that have been developed at SRI and elsewhere for verification, we are actually getting closer to, in some sense, claim that the software has a certain property. And so I think in some sense that was a great overview of what SRI has done and what you contributed to its profile. So thanks a lot, John. It was a real pleasure talking to you.
Yeah, well, thank you for this opportunity, and great pleasure to sit here in the warm sunshine and talk about the things we're all interested in.
Awesome.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Awesome.
And Wolfram, since this is our final interview of this 3 days, thank you.
Thanks, Charles. It was a real pleasure working with you. And
excellent.
I've seen not many places, lots of orange rooms and lots of Starbucks and coffee places, but it was great. Thanks
excellent.
A lot.
Take care.